This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Tyler Robinson allegedly confessed to killing Charlie Kirk in a handwritten note. He allegedly confessed in text messages. He allegedly confessed on Discord. He turned himself into the sheriff. His DNA is on the rifle. He's on surveillance video, climbing onto the rooftop, crawling into a shooting position, and fleeing after the shot. And somehow, the prosecution is still finding ways to make this case look complicated. That's what the story is about. Not whether Tyler Robinson killed Charlie Kirk. By every available piece of evidence, that question has an answer. This story is about every system that was supposed to prevent it, every institution that was supposed to solve it, and every professional who was supposed to prosecute it. Each one of them, in sequence, found a way to fail. Give me your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. This is not a story about politics. We are talking about a murder case, all right? So know that going in. I'm not going this side or that side. I'm talking truth to reality to power to what the hell's going on here, because none of this is it's making a whole lot of sense. It feels like there's a lot of incompetence at play here. Or I don't know. I don't know. And again, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube, there is no wrong answer. I'm just saying going into this, no, this is not a political piece, okay? Charlie Kirk was obviously one of the most recognizable political figures in the country. Like him, hate him, he was. He co-founded Turning Point USA, built the largest conservative youth movement in America, and was one of the closest allies to the sitting president outside of government. He had millions of followers. He had a wife, Erica, and two young children. He had a security team that traveled with him because he received constant threats. He was 31 years old. And whatever you thought of his politics, and people thought a lot about his politics, obviously, he was, in fact, a human being. He walked onto a college campus on September 10th of 25 to do something he'd done hundreds of times before. Set up a tent, took questions from students, and 14 minutes in, a single rifle round hit him in the neck. He died at a local hospital. His window was, his widow, in the courtroom at the preliminary hearing. His parents were there. His kids will now grow up without their father. So here's a question that we have to ask, and a question that nobody in a position of power in Utah seems to be able to answer. How did every layer of protection around this man evaporate? We're going to talk about that first, okay? And we're going to get some more things as we mosey on down this conversation. I'm throwing it out there. I'm throwing these questions out there. I'm not throwing them out there with an answer. I'm throwing them out there as a question, because they deserve answers. Let's start with the university. Utah Valley University's outdoor courtyard, the venue for the event. It sits in a bowl surrounded by multi-story buildings, rooftops with direct sight lines down into the speaking area. Kirk's security chief, Brian Harpole, says he flagged the rooftop exposure to UVU police chief Jeff Long 2 weeks before the actual event. He asked whether the university would station officers on the roof or let Harpole's team do it. According to Harpole, nobody was ever actually assigned. His 12-member private security detail built barricades and presidential-style zones around the stage, but their justification stopped at about 30 meters. They couldn't enter student buildings. They couldn't patrol rooftops. They couldn't make arrests. Everything beyond the bubble was supposedly the university's responsibility, from what we understand as of right now. And the university, by all available evidence, did almost nothing. Six officers, that's what UVU put on this event. Six campus police officers for a crowd. It was supposed to be about 600 and turned out to be more than 3,000. No drones, even though both Orem PD and the Utah County Sheriff's Office had drones. neither was asked to help. Fly around, keep an eye on things. Like the rooftops. That just might be a great place for somebody to go should they have ill intentions. No bag checks, no metal detectors, no dedicated ambulance. The university didn't even have a fire marshal on staff to help plan safety at large events, which is kind of basic for planning a large event. Sometimes you need like permits and things of that nature. I don't know how it works there in Utah, but it just seems like nobody really stepped up to the plate on the part of the university from my perspective. Why? And there may not be a big evil, dark conspiracy road to that. It may just be incompetence. Incompetence quite often does look like conspiracy. I don't know is what I'm saying to you. So don't think I'm going this way. I'm throwing the questions out there. And I'd love for you guys to weigh in. We have not talked about this story at very much length other than when it happened a year ago. But it's time that we have this conversation about what the hell's going on here. This wasn't some freak failure that nobody could have seen coming. Former campus public safety leaders speaking anonymously because they feared repercussions say they warned the administration for years. They say a university VP named Val Peterson allegedly told them in multiple budget meetings over the course of a decade that because a shooting hadn't happened on campus in decades, it wouldn't happen in the future. Oh, don't we trust that? Apparently they did. The campus budget was nearly $250 million. The public safety slice, $1.6 million. Former officers say they begged for more personnel, better pay, better resources. They say they were told no. It hasn't happened in a long time, guys. It's not going to happen. We're good. It's all good. And again, would that really surprise anyone? It's simple. I know it's simple. But that's kind of how incompetence works. After the shooting, when UVU's president was asked whether there was a security failure, her answer was, and I'm quoting, "Somebody was killed and that's a tragedy. I think that's what I would say right now." Then declined to answer further questions. That's the person in charge of the 48,000 student campus where a man was just killed from a rooftop that her own officers say they warned her about. And the shooter, he had all the time in the world. Surveillance footage shown at the preliminary hearing captures Tyler Robinson climbing over a railing from a public walkway onto the loose center roof at approximately 12:15 p.m. He crawled into a prone position. A former UVU officer found the impressions in gravel afterward, elbows, knees, feet all pointed at Kirk's tent. The officer called it a sniper pad. Robinson was lying on that roof in position for at least 7 minutes before he fired. 7 minutes on an unsecured rooftop with a direct line of sight to a highly politicized target. Nobody checked. Nobody was there to check. So Kirk is killed. 3,000 people just watch a man get shot. Those are the ones in person, the millions who then have that image now forever scorched into our brains. What does law enforcement do? They arrest the wrong person. 71-year-old man named George Zinn walked up to a campus officer in the chaos 2 minutes after the gunshot and said, "I shot him. Now shoot me." He was handcuffed immediately. Videos of his arrest went viral. Social media declared the shooter had been caught. And then the FBI director posted on social media that the subject in Kirk's shooting was in custody. Utah's governor said a person of interest was apprehended. All of it was wrong. Zinn was a serial disruptor with a 30-year history of showing up at political events and getting removed. He later told officers he did it to draw attention from the real shooter, that he wanted to be a martyr His false confession diverted multiple officers from securing the scene and searching for the actual gunman. After they searched his phone, they found illegal material that led to a separate prosecution and a sentence of up to 15 years on charges that had nothing to do with Charlie Kirk. A second individual was also detained and released. None of it led to Robinson. You know what led to Robinson? His parents. The FBI released surveillance photos. Robinson's own mother and father recognized their son, confronted him, and convinced him to surrender. He turned himself into the Washington County Sheriff roughly 33 hours after the shooting. 7,000 tips came in. $100,000 reward was posted. The greatest law enforcement apparatus on earth was mobilized, and Tyler Robinson was identified because his mom and dad saw his picture and said, "That's our kid. That's our little boy. Look at him now. Oh, God, look at him now." Let's be clear about what the prosecution has, because on paper, this case is a freight train. Robinson allegedly left a handwritten note for his roommate and romantic partner, Lance Twiggs, before leaving for UVU that morning. According to prosecutors, the note said, "I had the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk and I took it." It continued, "I wish we could have lived in a world where this did not feel necessary." He allegedly texted Twiggs after the shooting, "I had enough of his hatred. Some hate can't be negotiated out." He allegedly posted in a Discord group, "It was me at UVU yesterday. I'm sorry." Twiggs told investigators that Robinson came home the next day, paced through the apartment, cried, and said he wished he hadn't done it. His DNA is on the rifle. His DNA is on the towel the rifle was wrapped in. An ATF forensic biologist testified he was a primary DNA contributor to the weapon. Shell casings found in his apartment were matched to the same rifle by ATF testing. A Dremel tool seized from the home was determined to have made the engravings on the bullet casings. Casings found both at the scene and in his apartment. Those engravings say things like, "Hey, fascist, catch," with gaming arrows, lyrics from the Italian anti-fascist song Bella Ciao. Internet culture references, one casing at his apartment was engraved with the words "test shot." Surveillance video shows him on the UVU campus on the roof and fleeing after the shot. That's not up for negotiation. Alleged confessions in three formats, DNA on the weapon, matched shell casings, matched tool marks, surveillance footage of voluntary surrender. The defense across 5 days of preliminary hearing testimony offered no alternative theory. They did not suggest anyone else killed Charlie Kirk. Robinson declined to testify. This should be the most open and shut case in the Utah County Attorney's Office, bar none. So why does it feel like it's falling apart? Start with the bullet. The ATF tested a bullet jacket fragment recovered from recovered during Kirk's autopsy against the Mauser rifle. Inconclusive. The bullet hit bone, fragmented on impact, and the remains were too damaged for microscopic comparison. Forensic experts say this is not unusual. I know the internet's filled with theories. I have talked myself with ballistics experts, and you've probably seen them, and you've probably seen many, 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 many people. And ballistics experts who are not political, who just are telling you how this stuff works, have explained it. Forensics experts say it's not unusual. A 2022 study of a 79 firearm examiners found that they report inconclusive findings in roughly 20% of casework. The way a bullet fires from a rifle is different than the way it fires from a handgun. Brian Anton just did a really good report on that. Check out his channel. Very interesting. Talking with a ballistics expert. That's probably one of the best ways I've seen this explained. I do recommend that if you want to dive in to understanding those ballistics more, because to me that also stood out as being a little different, weird. What do you mean? Prosecution cannot forensically prove the bullet that killed Charlie Kirk came from the rifle they recovered near campus. The spent shell casing matches. The casings from Robinson's apartment match. Everything around the bullet connects. The bullet itself doesn't. Not because it came from somewhere else, because it was too destroyed to test. That gap is a speed bump, not a sinkhole. Prosecutors have mountains of other evidence, but instead of treating it like a speed bump, the prosecution drove straight into it and flipped the car. After the defense referenced the inconclusive report in a court filing, media coverage went sideways. Tabloid headline declared the bullet didn't match the rifle. Not true. Conspiracy theorists called Robinson a patsy. The prosecution's own spokesperson, Deputy Utah County Attorney Christopher Ballard, went on to media tour, TMZ, USA Today, PolitiFact, Fox News. He was allowed to correct the misinformation about the ballistics report under the court's pretrial publicity rules, but he couldn't stop there. He told TMZ the prosecutors had ample evidence to overcome the presumption of innocence. He editorialized about the strength of his own case in an active death penalty prosecution with a pretrial publicity order in place. Here's what you can do. Here's what you can't do. Oh, you went way over that line. Judge Tony Graff held Ballard in civil contempt. The corrections about the ballistics report were permissible. The comments about the strength of the case were not. The judge said those statements possessed a substantial likelihood of materially prejudicing the proceedings. Why is that important, even if what he's saying is correct? Because you don't want to do this for the next 20 years. You don't want to go down a road where there's going to be a gazillion ways of possibly getting a retrial, of appellate issues. Just pull the emotions down for a moment and do your job. You're the professional here. Let's play within the rules of where you're supposed to go so you don't create appellate issues down the road. The judge is calling out that shit. The defense asked for the death penalty to be removed as a sanction. Graff declined, calling it grossly disproportionate, but ordered expanded jury sanction procedures and made the prosecution reimburse the defense's legal costs. Let me put that in plain English. The prosecutor who is supposed to be building a case for the death penalty got himself held in contempt of court for talking to TMZ in a case where the defendant allegedly confessed three times. The defense will carry that contempt finding into every future proceeding. Good job. The jury pool, already soaked in political media coverage and conspiracy theories, got harder to seat. And the prosecution did it to themselves. Nobody made them pick up the phone and talk to TMZ. Twiggs, the key witness, the roommate, the person Robinson allegedly confessed to in person, did not testify live at the preliminary hearing. His testimony was a pre-recorded video from April of 26, heavily redacted by the judge. He received limited immunity, which is important. When shown surveillance photos of the suspect, he said he couldn't identify the man with 100% certainty because of the camera quality. The defense fought to suppress the video entirely. This is the prosecution's star witness, and the jury, if this gets to trial, will see a screen, not a person. Closing arguments on probable cause are now set for September 1st. If Judge Graff finds the evidence sufficient, Robinson will be arraigned and enter pleas for the first time, nearly a year after Kirk was killed. And if it goes to trial, the death penalty stays on the table. Robinson faces seven charges, including aggravated murder. Nobody in that courtroom, not the prosecution, not the defense, not the judge, is disputing that Charlie Kirk was killed, father of two, a man whose wife sat in the gallery and watched surveillance footage of a rooftop and turned to embrace his crying mother. That happened. It's real. The question was never really who did this. The question is whether the people responsible for accountability at the university and the investigation in the courtroom are capable of delivering it. Because so far at every single checkpoint where someone was supposed to do their job, something went wrong. The university ignored rooftop warnings, the investigation arrested the wrong people, and the prosecution spokesperson got held in contempt. The bullet can't be matched. The key witness testified on video. Tyler Robinson allegedly told his roommate he wished he hadn't done it. That may be the only honest statement anyone involved in this case has made. Because every institution that touched this case, everyone, should be saying the same thing. Why aren't they? Again, your thoughts in the comment section. I am not trying to make this political at all. We are talking about a murder case. Like him, hate him, whatever. That's insignificant. We're talking about the law, how this is prosecuted, how this is defended, how it is following those rules, how this was investigated. There's a lot at play And again, a lot of incompetency, which, as we always say, the incompetency can so often masquerade as conspiracy. And look, I'm not telling you anything's right or wrong here. I don't know the answer. But just keep that in mind. It is easy to go down the conspiracy routes on this case. It is easy to, I'm not telling you not to. I'm just saying, be careful. Incompetence masks conspiracy all the time. I'm telling you from the hundreds and hundreds of cases we cover, oftentimes simple does turn out to be reality, but who knows? Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I look forward to continuing our conversation there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
A 22-year-old kid took his grandfather's hunting rifle, drove to a college campus, and shot one of the most famous political figures in America in front of 3,000 people. He left a confession sitting under the keyboard in his bedroom. He told his boyfriend what he'd done. His own parents recognized him and talked him into surrendering. And somewhere between that day and this one, the whole industry decided none of it actually happened the way it obviously happened. There are more than a dozen theories about Charlie Kirk's death. Some of them are just noise. Some of them have real reach, real money behind them, and enough true believers that they've become their own kind of fact. So let's take those two, put them next to evidence that actually has come out, that you can, in fact, see with your own eyes, and see what survives. There's a lot in this case, and this is not a political piece. I am not here to say anything about Charlie's political beliefs, agree, disagree, whatever. Everyone's entitled to their own opinions. This is not that. This is a murder case. This is about facts of a case. Beliefs and politics have nothing to do with what we are about to be talking about. So let's be clear on that. And I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube, or wherever you're watching this, as we work our way through all of it. All right. Especially if you're someone who's now been following this at any great length, maybe you're hearing more and more about it and you're like, well, what about this? What about that? I'm going to try and go through some of the things out there, some of the noise that is out there on this case that is clearly easily debunkable, if you will, or explained, or just really being correctly informed on. In case you haven't had a chance to dig into it yourself, I'm going to try and help you with that. I did the digging. You certainly can. No one is stopping you from checking the facts or anything like that. But if you're looking for a way to kind of go, oh, okay, that puts it into a little better perspective for me to understand. This is a video for you. The first theory is that Tyler Robinson is a patsy, that he was framed. And maybe he wasn't even on that campus. The second theory is that the shot came from somewhere else or from somebody else. There was a second shooter. And that Robinson is taking the fall. Those are the two big ones we're going to talk about today. All right. I know there's a gazillion more out there, but we got to start somewhere. Okay. And we'll probably cover more as time goes on, but let's start here. The loudest voice pushing the theory, the Patsy theory, as you probably know, Candace Owens, who worked alongside Charlie Kirk at Turning Point USA. She has said she feels confident that Tyler Robinson did not murder Charlie Kirk. She has called him a total patsy who wasn't even there that day. She's pointed at Kirk's widow, at Turning Point staff, at foreign governments, which she's never done across dozens of episodes, is name who actually did it and explain how. It's doubt pointed in a lot of directions and never landing on anything you can check. And I want to take a moment here because she's a human being too. Before people are like, oh, she's crazy. Like, she's a human being who lost a very good friend. And it sounds like they had a very unique relationship between the two of them, both in media, both with so much similar viewpoints on things. If you lose your friend in such a tragic way, in a senseless way, if you've ever lost, think about it, if you've ever lost someone in a senseless, tragic way, whether it be to something like this, murder, a drunk driver, something where there was so much more life in your friend or your loved one, and it was extinguished senselessly, you're going to want to believe there's more of a reason to it than some narcissistic 20-some-year-old psychopath that decided it was their duty to play God that day. Again, whether you, nothing about their beliefs, you can't, we don't do that. We don't just go kill people for things like this. You're going to want to believe there's something deeper. There's a deeper meaning behind it. That's human. And it's not to say that that is going to pan out, that there's going to be a deeper meaning or there's going to be something bigger and more conspiratorial and all that behind it. And I say, look, good on anyone for digging anywhere and not just accepting facts on facts. But when you have, I mean, a lot of facts here, DNA, video, I mean, there's a lot. At some point, you got to go, well, here's reality and here's not reality. Here's emotion. Here's fact. They're two different things. But I get the vigor. I get the anger. I get the passion. I get how minds can get caught up in what I guess you could call almost say the fog of war. And sometimes in those moments, you can go down paths that look pretty clear and factual to you, even though to many of the rest of the world, it does not, because sometimes you're just too close to the sun. That's how I understand it. That's how I understand that sort of a dynamic. Let's check what we can. Okay. It's doubt pointed in a lot of directions and never landing on anything you can check. So let's check. And your thoughts in the comments section, Substack, YouTube, like I said, as we go through this. Tyler Robinson wrote a note. It's not really in question. Investigators found it under the keyboard in his room. In it, he said he had the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk, and he was going to take it. After the shooting, he texted his roommate, his boyfriend, Lance Twiggs, telling him he'd had enough of Kirk's hatred, which, again, there are certainly many, many things that Charlie Kirk has said in his life that would make people angry, that they would disagree with vehemently. Now, it's not for me here to say right now, I'm not making this political. I'm not here to say you shouldn't be angry or you should be angry. But look, it's cause and effect. he was a polarizing figure with his, and I think he would admit that too. I mean, it is what it is. It is what it is. When you say things that are going to upset large swaths of people, some of those people are going to not necessarily have the restraint that others have. We're going to go, that's their opinion. They're clearly wrong. I don't agree with them. But I'm going to move on with my day. Some people's minds don't go there. Some people's minds go to, I must take that person out. I must destroy that person. I must remove that person from the planet because they are being perceived to that individual as a threat to their very existence. And that's the danger of very heated speech in any direction. Triggs told investigators that Robinson came home, paced around the apartment, cried, and said he wished he hadn't done it. You think? The physical evidence is where the Patsy theory stops being an argument. An FBI analyst testified about the DNA on the towel the rifle was wrapped in. The male DNA on that towel was roughly 1.7 octillion times more likely to belong to Robinson and Twiggs than to Twiggs and some random stranger. That's a one with seven zeros after it. Investigators found spent shell casings at Robinson's apartment. The ATF matched those casings to the murder weapon. And they matched the engraving tool that made the marks on those cases to a Dremel rotary tool sitting in Robinson's own home. And while we're on those engravings, honestly, honesty has to cut both ways in this case. In the first days after the shooting, there was a widely repeated claim that the casings were engraved with transgender ideology, some kind of coded message. That was actually false. What was actually cut into the brass was internet meme junk, a video game reference, and a line from an old Italian anti-fascist song. That claim got repeated at very high levels, and it was wrong. Being wrong about this case is not a partisan sport. People on every side of it have grabbed the detail that fits their story and run with it before checking whether it was even true. That's exactly how a case like this fills up with theories in the first place. And if you're on reality's side here, which I am, you have to go with where the facts are. Even if it doesn't necessarily get on a narrative that you want it to, or it, because it argues point or emotion stronger. For the Patsy theory to be true, all of it has to be planted. That's a big one. So if we're to believe this is all somehow not him, the note, the text, the DNA, the casings, the tool. His parents have to be lying about recognizing their own son. Twiggs has to be lying under a grant of immunity. And Robinson himself, sitting in a Provo courtroom in a gray suit facing the death penalty, has to be choosing to protect the people who framed him instead of saying a single word to save his own life. When you look at the guy, do you think this is a guy who's like, oh, I'm going to stand up for the people who framed me and go down and not say, it was this, it was that government, it was this person, it was like, yeah. And then you also got to think, these larger than life entities picked that guy to execute their plan. I don't know. If you're a massive government or you're this or that, I think you might have more qualified hit people than Tyler Robinson. Just saying. It's the part that breaks it. And it isn't even a forensic point. It's common sense. If you're powerful enough to fake FBI DNA results and frame an innocent man, you'd not pick this guy. You don't pick the kid who leaves a written confession under a keyboard, tells his boyfriend, and gets turned in by his own mom and dad. You pick a ghost, a drifter, someone with no phone, no partner, no family paying attention. The Patsy theory asks you to believe in a conspiracy sophisticated enough to fool the FBI lab and stupid enough to frame the one person guaranteed to get caught. Part of the Patsy theory is the claim that Robinson wasn't even on that campus. Okay, so look at what the surveillance actually showed. The lead investigator testified that Robinson's movements were tracked in and out of that campus four separate times that day. His car pulls into the parking garage in the morning, walks over to the courtyard where the event is going to happen and talks with Turning Point staff. He leaves. He comes back later, buys food, walks into a wooded area carrying a backpack, comes back out without it. Same wooded area where the rifle wrapped in a towel was later recovered. A man who was framed and never present doesn't show up on campus cameras four times and doesn't get filmed walking into the exact patch of woods where the murder weapon turns up. And the towel matters too, because it ties the woods to the bedroom. The DNA on it comes back to Robinson and his boyfriend. The rifle inside it belonged to Robinson's own grandfather. This is not a weapon that appeared out of nowhere with a stranger's story attached to it. It's a family gun carried by a man captured on camera, wrapped in a towel, carrying his DNA, left in woods he was filmed walking into. Every link in that chain points at the same person, and none of them points anywhere else. That's the first theory. And I am all ears if you have a sensible way of debunking anything I just said. I am all ears in the comments. As I say with everything, I could be wrong. I am just trying to assemble the facts and present them in a clear way, as unbiased as I possibly can. And this is a story that is ripe for conspiracy and very segmented opinions. That's the first theory. Now the second one. Let's go there. And this is the one that takes some actual work, because it's built on things that sound genuinely strange until you understand them. The second shooter theory feeds on anomalies. And there are three big ones that get repeated over and over. And there's some, I would say, rather bluntly, shitty investigative work that went on. And shitty investigative work often looks like conspiracy. So let's take them one at a time and give each one as straight of an answer as we can. Anomaly number one. There were no shell casings found on the rooftop. People hear that and they think, well, if somebody fired a rifle from up there, where's the brass? A shooter leaves casings behind. An empty roof means nobody fired from it. Well, here's the answer. The murder weapon was a Mauser Model 98. It's a bolt-action rifle. A bolt-action does not throw its brass. When you fire it, the spent casing stays inside the chamber until you manually work the bolt to eject it. That's the whole design. So a shooter using a bolt-action rifle leaves no brass on the ground because the casing is still in the gun, and that is exactly where investigators found it. When they recovered that rifle, wrapped in a towel in a wooded area near campus, there was one spent casing still in the chamber, along with three unfired rounds. The brass was never missing. It was in the rifle, precisely where a bolt action leaves it. Now, if you don't know guns, I don't. It sounds weird to me, too. And it's like, okay. Now I know. There was never going to be a casing on that roof unless he ejected it and walked away. And he didn't. And number two. A second bullet was found on the roof of a different building. This one gets a lot of mileage because it sounds like proof of a second gun in a second location. A second bullet means a second shooter, right? And if you stop right there, holy whoa. The answer to that is that the round was a live 223 cartridge, unfired, still fully intact. it was ejected by a police officer clearing his own patrol rifle during the massive law enforcement response after the shooting. You rack the gun. Came up. Well, it's still a bullet. You know, Charlie Kirk was killed with a 30-06. A 223 is a completely different cartridge. It is the standard round police officers carry in their patrol rifles. So the mysterious second bullet was an unfired police round that popped out of an officer's gun while he was handling it. It was never fired at anyone. It has nothing to do with the shooting. Different caliber, unfired, dropped by a cop, and completely explainable. That's the entire story. I know. But what? No, there's not more. That happens. Given an active shooter situation, the cop's getting his gun ready in case it needs to be used. Anomaly number three, and this is the strongest card the theory holds, so it means it deserves a real answer. The ATF could not match the bullet that killed Charlie Kirk to the rifle. That's true. It is not a rumor. An ATF firearms examiner testified that the bullet fragment recovered from Kirk's body could not be identified or excluded as coming from that Mauser. Inconclusive. Whoa. That sounds big. But you have to understand what inconclusive means and what it doesn't mean. It does not mean the bullet came from a different gun. It means there weren't enough usable marks left on the fragment to make a comparison either way. The bullet was too damaged. And the casing tells the same story a bullet normally would. That spent casing in the rifle's chamber was matched to the rifle. The casings in Robinson's apartment were matched to the rifle. The rifle was in Robinson's possession with his DNA on the towel around it. The bullet couldn't be matched because it shattered on impact, not because it came from somewhere else. The forensic chain doesn't have a hole in it. It just runs through the brass instead of the bullet. But how did that bullet, how did his body stop that? Well, I'll tell you something. And look, I'm not a firearms expert, but I know several. I've talked to several. I'm sure we'll be talking to far more in the coming weeks and months. Here's the thing. A bullet from a handgun and a bullet from a rifle travel very differently. I have seen several firearms experts talk about this now. Several have testified. Here's a prime example, because it is shocking to think of, like, this powerful rifle. How did his body stop the bullet? And look, to the layperson like myself, it sounds like, well, that's weird. If you talk to a firearms expert, they will explain to you how these bullets travel. The way essentially they are swirling in the air or not. A rifle bullet is swirling in the air. And upon impact, whew, the best example that I have heard thus far, and I hope this resonates or helps me make some more sense about this. People that have a lot of experience in this world have testified of shooting into a vehicle. Sometimes the headrest, just a cushion and a headrest of a vehicle will stop a rifle bullet, but not a handgun bullet. It has everything to do with the physics, and I'm not here to do a physics lesson. But look, you can look this up, you can do your research, or you can just scream at me, you're wrong! Do your research. You'll find the same information. The physics of it, to the layperson, they seem weird. But then you start looking at actual research done that has nothing to do with the Charlie Kirk case, done while Charlie Kirk was alive, before he was even born. I mean, it's the physics of how these things work. The body could, in fact, stop that bullet. I know. I thought it was odd, too. But then I also said, I have zero knowledge of how this stuff works. So maybe I should yield to the experts. that have nothing to do with this case that are talking about these sort of bullets and trajectories and dynamics and aerodynamics and physics and all of that, completely independent of the Charlie Kirk case, and go, oh, that's interesting. The more you know. So there's that. That's the three big anomalies. And all three have answers. But I'm not going to stand here and tell you this investigation was clean, because it wasn't. There's one thing in this case that genuinely hasn't been resolved, and I'm not going to pretend otherwise. After the shooting, an officer found an empty pistol holster lying in the grass in the courtyard. He didn't know whose it was. Then, at the hearing, the defense pointed out that a different officer's report said a gun was actually found in that holster. One account says empty. The other says there was a gun. That contradiction has not been cleared up. And it's a real loose end, that the defense is going to pounce on. But look at what that loose end actually is. It's not evidence of a second shooter. It's evidence that the scene was worked sloppily and that the paperwork doesn't line up. A holster in the grass with two conflicting reports tells you the investigation had gaps, that security absolutely sucked. It does not tell you somebody else killed Charlie Kirk. Sloppy is not the same thing as staged, and that distinction is the whole ballgame, because almost every anomaly that these theories are built on comes down to the same thing. Not a conspiracy, just people not doing their jobs cleanly and leaving holes that got filled in with something more exciting than the truth. Which brings me to the single fact that should end this entire conversation, and it has nothing to do with ballistics or DNA. Tyler Robinson has a defense attorney named Catherine Nestor. Some would say she's good, and her client is facing execution. She has access to every piece of evidence the state is holding, including material the public will never see. Over 5 days of testimony, she went after the state's case hard. She found the dead body camera, the sloppy holster, the witnesses who were never interviewed. She got an FBI analyst to admit that DNA testing can't tell you when or how someone's DNA got onto an object. She found every weak point there was to find. And there were more than there should have been. And in 5 days, with her client's life on the table, she never once suggested that somebody else killed Charlie Kirk. Not a second shooter, not another location, not one alternate version of what happened. Her entire defense wasn't that the state hasn't proven its case, not that some other person pulled the trigger. The one human being on this planet with the most to gain from a second shooter and every piece of evidence in front of her to find one did not name one, because there isn't one to name. That's not my opinion. That's what the record shows. Charlie Kirk was 31 years old. He had a wife and two small children. Whatever you thought of him, he was a man who walked onto a campus to answer questions from students and never walked off of it. His family has asked for privacy while they bury him and raise his kids without him. They deserve a story about his death that is true. And I know, look, there's people are like, ask for privacy, and then we have fireworks going off at the funeral. I know. That's a whole other conversation. I'm talking about the murder case. I'm talking about the actual murder. You have a young man who had his grandfather's rifle, made a terrible choice, tried to get away with it, and did it. It is not a comfortable story, but it has a singular advantage of being real. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. And as I say with everything, I could be wrong. Always open to hear your thoughts, contradictory thoughts, and really listening. But as the evidence is right now, that's where it sits. We'll continue our conversation on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts. We do greatly appreciate that. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.